Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. It's been 3 years since Michael Brown was shot dead on the streets of Ferguson by police officer Darren Wilson. The incident unleashed a series of actions from protests over the shooting to legal and legislative initiatives to address complaints of racial disparity. In Ferguson right now, a moment of silence has just been observed in Brown's memory. A march is also planned. We begin with St. Louis Public Radio reporter Rachel Lippman covering the memorial ceremony for Michael Brown. Rachel, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure, Don. Thanks for having me.
Set the stage for us. What's going on at this moment?
So we are in the Canfield Green apartment complex, which is off of West Florissant Drive. Right now there is a dance program or some sort of dance demonstration going on right near the site where Michael Brown was shot and killed by Darren Wilson. There's a memorial in the middle of the street with roses, as well as that permanent plaque a little bit farther down the street.
And the crowd size?
I hate to make any kind of estimation because I'm really bad at it. It's probably within the range of triple digits, but I wouldn't call it anything, you know, like a massive, overwhelming crowd.
And a march is planned, as I understand it, as well?
There's a march planned to a local park as well, yes. They had a moment of silence and some speeches, a release of a dove, and as I mentioned right now, there's a dance demonstration by a group calling themselves the Peacekeepers.
I want to just take a moment, Rachel, because you've been on this story for, since day one, 3 years ago today, and just get some sense from you as to any major changes you might have seen as a result of this shooting and its aftermath. Is anything really very much different that you can point to?
I think if you're talking about physically, the big difference is that the Quick Trip is gone, and in its place is the new Urban League of St. Louis Salvation Army joint building. They've gotten all of the rubble cleared from the looting that followed both after Michael Brown was killed and after the grand jury was announced that they would not be indicting Mike Brown. I think the changes that really have happened is what you can't see necessarily. There's been reforms pushed by the federal government, reforms pushed through litigation by other groups. And if you talk to people, they'll say, yeah, there's been some progress that's made. But if there's still a sense that not everything that they have wanted to has been accomplished. And it's still going to take further legal action to keep Ferguson from backsliding. And I think there's some concern as to what happens is, if the watchful eye disappears. It's still 3 years. This is still, a new event. What happens at 5 years? What happens at 10 years? What happens at 15 years? Does it just become another date on the calendar? And when the eyes are gone, what will really permanently stay changed?
Well, we'll be exploring that further on today's program. Rachel Lippman, thank you for being with us. And I know you've got more reporting to do, but thank you for spending some time with us.
Great as always to be here, Don.
The Brown shooting and its aftermath led to lots of talk about social, legislative, and law enforcement reform. Have we put our money where our mouth is? Is anything different for the community and for you? Joining us to talk about it are Amy Hunter, the manager of diversity and inclusion for St. Louis Children's Hospital. She has become a national voice on issues of race and social justice. She's with me in studio. Also in studio is Wesley Bell, an attorney, a member of the Ferguson City Council. He teaches law and criminology at Flow Valley Community College. He's also a former municipal judge and the son of a police officer. Journalist and attorney Bill Frivol joins us by phone. And joining us for a few minutes is Professor Rick Rosenfeld of the Criminology Department at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. We'll have other voices as well, including yours. What changes do you see after Ferguson? Give us a call at 382-8255 or email us or send us a tweet. I'll begin with questions to each of my guests, both in studio and on the phone. I'll start with Amy Hunter. Lots of talk of reform, Amy, over the last 3 years. How well have we done?
I think we could do better, of course. I think there have been some changes, but mothers are still having the talks with their sons. We're still preparing for police violence in the streets. We're still having conversations about racial profiling in our schools and certainly in the healthcare system as well. And so I don't think we're done, not even close to done. If these things were happening to our white American fellow citizens, I think we would move much faster. And I think people would be much more aware. So I think we have a long way to go to educate more people and to make more changes. Racial profiling is still happening.
Wesley Bell, how about you? How well have we done?
Well, I think you have to first be specific on what we're talking about, where we're changing, because oftentimes we use Ferguson synonymous with broader change that we need to. And so in Ferguson, I would still say the same thing. There's a lot more that we need to do. I would agree. There's a lot that has been done. But more importantly, you know, Ferguson is a small city. So more importantly, what's going on regionally, what's going on nationally? And we do still need to see a lot more with the community policing, with court reforms. We still got a lot to do.
In terms of the speed with which whatever has happened what's your thought about that?
Well, I think Ms. Lipman pointed out that there's going to require legal action. I would push back and say, no, there's going to require political action. And when you saw the voters come out in Ferguson, you saw a lot of quick change. You saw a lot of quick fixes to some things sustainable, some things that we have to keep our eye on, obviously. But I think it's important that people have to get out and vote, because you can file lawsuit after lawsuit. But if you're not involved in the political side where the decisions are made, you're not going to see the change that you want. So I would say get out, vote.
Amy, Hunter, the same question to you with regard to the speed with which whatever has happened or not happened has occurred.
Yeah, I think we can move much faster. I mean, the civil rights movement was 50 years ago. And so, you know, how long? We have been patient. We've been respectable. We've been all the things that we've been asked to be. I think Ferguson was a good example of how tired people are of being St. Louis, right? And not just here in St. Louis, but around the world, around the country. And so I think we could move much faster. I think people are still not aggressively looking at this. I, of course, would encourage people to vote. People died for our rights to vote. I also understand, you know, the hopelessness that people are feeling. We've had case after case of police shootings, and not one has been found guilty yet. And so, you know, I think people are losing faith in our criminal injustice system, and I think justly so. So systems need to change. I think easily we could pick on Ferguson. Easily we could pick on the police. I think we're looking at this much broader. What are our systems around racism look like? What is this? How do we want to enforce change? And for the people that are getting really stuck, pretend like this is happening to white boys all over the country. White boys all over the country are being killed by police officers, and they're unarmed, as early as 12 or 14 years of age, playing in a park, getting traffic stopped. I am sure if that had been the case, things would have moved much faster. And so I think we need to have a conversation about, you know, our cognitive dissonance, how we've decided that black people don't really matter, that we're not going to miss them if something should happen to them, and then move with rapid speed as if they are white, if that's all we can imagine.
You did say racial injustice system. I'm sure that's what you intended to say.
Absolutely.
Right. Let me turn to our other guests now. I'll start with Bill Freivogel. Bill, same question to you that I started with regard to reform and how well we've done. You come at it from the point of view of an attorney and also a journalist, and you've watched very carefully the legislative action. Your thoughts?
Well, I would agree with what's been said so far. We've taken a few steps in the right direction, but we have a lot more steps to go. I mean, I think Ferguson was the reason that Black Lives Matter emerged as a new face of the civil rights movement, and a lot of that through the power of Twitter and social media, spread its message around the country, awakened a lot of people that we haven't solved the civil rights issues yet, awakened, I think, some whites to the idea of white privilege. Ferguson was like the pinnacle of the Obama Justice Department enforcing federal law, you know, where they find patterns and practices of unconstitutional police behavior. But then, you know, then there's the flip side. Donald Trump ran effectively against Black Lives Matter, and he won. His Justice Department's run by Jeff Sessions, who doesn't believe in these kinds of consent decrees that we have in Ferguson to try to get rid of the unconstitutional police practices. And as a matter of fact, then told his civil rights lawyers he doesn't want them use consent decrees for court enforcement of civil rights. Sort of the same thing on the state level. The Missouri Supreme Court implemented some minimum standards for functioning of muni courts. Municipal courts are doing better. Judge Beach, the presiding judge in St. Louis County, is by all counts doing a terrific job, whereas his predecessor did not. But there still are way too many small municipal courts in St. Louis County and around the state.
I'll turn to Rick Rosenfeld now. Rick, with this notion of reform, law enforcement is your specialty. How about reform within the police community, if you will, since Ferguson? What are you seeing?
Well, I'm seeing more training with respect to use of force and somewhat greater sensitivity on the part of St. Louis County Police Department, also the City Police Department, with respect to police-community relations. But, Don, I'm also seeing a sharp and quite abrupt rise in both St. Louis City and St. Louis County in violent crime. In 2014, for example, there were 34 homicides that occurred in St. Louis County. The following year, there were 61. And the year after that, last year, 2016, there were 65. That's almost a doubling in homicides in a relatively short period of time that coincides almost exactly with the Michael Brown killing and other controversial use of force incidents across the country, as well as community unrest associated with those incidents. So among the other changes that the police need to make, they need to get a handle on the increase in homicides in St. Louis County as well as St. Louis City. I should say that these increases are not distinctive to the St. Louis area. Most large cities in 2015 and again in 2016 saw their homicide rates go up.
I would have to ask this question. We've talked about this before. Some people attribute this to what they call the Ferguson effect on police officers, kind of stepping back, concern. Your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I don't think that's what's happening in the city or in the county. I don't know of any evidence that the police are disengaging from active or proactive enforcement. What I do think is happening, one of your guests has already mentioned, and that is what we're seeing is a manifestation of the lack of trust in, lack of faith in the police and other aspects of the criminal justice system on the part of many members of the community. When people lose confidence in the police, they tend to draw back. They don't report crimes, even when they've been the victims. They're less likely to cooperate with the police in investigating crimes, and they're more likely to take matters in their own hands when disputes arise, and that gives rise to violence. I should also say that what we may be seeing in both the city and the county are the effects of expanding drug markets brought about by the opioid and heroin epidemic of the last few years. So there may be a mixture of reasons why we saw this abrupt increase, but I do think one is another version of the Ferguson effect, and that is alienation from the police on the part of some members of communities in St. Louis and St. Louis County.
Wesley Bell, you teach criminology. What are your thoughts with regard to this? Are you in sync with Mr. Rosenfeld?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Professor Rosenfeld said, and that's why I'm such a proponent of community policing, because when you build that confidence, when you build that trust, we got the data. It shows. You'll see more confidence not only in officers doing their job, but also with the residents feeling comfortable reporting things. And so a lot of that has to do with training and retraining, I should say. Officers have to not see themselves as warriors anymore, but guardians. In Ferguson, for example, we require 60 hours now of in-service training per year of our officers. The state requirement is 24. Now, what that also includes, which a lot of departments aren't doing, is what it was called Blue Courage training, which addresses the mental health and stress of officers. But then two that I find very interesting and I'm passionate about, one would be implicit bias training. A lot of departments have not gotten that kind of training historically, and that's so important because we all carry around these biases that we're not aware of. And you have to be aware of them. You have to know about these when you're interacting with the public. And then also de-escalation. Mm-hmm. Officers are taught how to increase the force on the force continuum, if you will. But we need to focus on how they de-escalate force on the force continuum.
If I may.
Absolutely.
Yes, we all carry implicit bias, but we don't all carry guns and the right to kill people if we feel threatened, right? And so I think we have to look at the way that systems are feeding into each other. We've got a heroin and opioid epidemic, and the police are in collusion with our healthcare system, right? We had a crack epidemic, and crack addicts were not taken to the hospital. Now people on drugs are being taken to the hospital. So again, I think if we keep putting this into just policing, we're going to miss the big picture of the systemic piece of it. We know how to reduce crime. Employment reduces crime. So how many of our major corporations here in St. Louis are hiring people in those zip codes that are unlucky zip codes, right? We know how to reduce crime. We improve our school systems. And what has the effort been to improving our school systems in real, authentic ways so that John Burroughs and MICDS look like Styx Middle or Ashland School, that, you know, where you live doesn't predetermine whether or not only you're going to get stopped by the police, but lose your life and potentially graduate from high school. Like, I think we need to start saying what is true. And what is true is that we have system problems. Our systems are feeding into the way that people feel oppressed, which decreases our voter turnout, which increases things like crime.
And I'd like to jump in because I was told to talk about the policing aspect, but I couldn't agree more. We have to, if we want to really reduce crime, we do have to look at it holistically. When you see the communities that have the highest crime rates, you tend to see the worst school systems. Yep. And we're okay with that. We seem to write off certain school systems and say, well, this area, we're okay with a bad school system, but if you take it out to West County or somewhere like that, we'd be up in arms when the school systems drop below accreditation. And in at-risk communities, it seems as though accreditation is the goal. In a lot of these communities, they get accredited and we're celebrating when that shouldn't be the goal. The goal should be the gold standards of education, particularly in our at-risk communities.
It would seem to be – go ahead.
We can't imagine not over-policing Black people. Like, we cannot imagine not increasing police departments to police Black bodies in this – and I say that holistically. I mean that in schools we're policing Black bodies, in the streets we're policing Black bodies. And so I want us to imagine a St. Louis where you could actually just live and be employed and healthy and happy and walk your streets in your neighborhoods.
You know, Wesley Bell, what you said about what's going on in Ferguson sounds pretty positive to me with regard to law enforcement in terms of the training and some of the things that are being done. Would you agree that there's a positive tone to this?
I always have to preface it by saying we have to do more and we can't drop the ball. But I will say there are some good things going. Our Chief Moss, Chief Delrich Moss, is implementing a program which will have social workers embedded with law enforcement officers, because a lot of officers aren't trained to handle some of these mental health issues. We decrease our mental health budgets across the country, and then we throw that in the lap of officers who are not prepared for it.
But, and to be clear, if they were doing so great, people would be flocking there as well. So I think part of what we're looking at is, what are people saying? Are the people in Ferguson saying it's so much nicer to live in Ferguson? Are people from UCity flocking to Ferguson because the policing is so lessened? I mean, those are the things that we, like, in an ideal situation, Ferguson would have happened and then it would have become the mecca for everything positive.
Well, we do have some input from the folks out there. And of course, this is just one voice being heard. Nicole from Ferguson says, I never felt tension before the Michael Brown shooting. She says, but now, since that, it's become an us versus them kind of situation still in Ferguson. Wesley Bell, does that sound right to you?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about racial and as Amy said, specifically systemic race issues and things of that nature, these things predate Ferguson. These things are not just Ferguson or regional. These are national, international, if you will. So, yes, you're going to see, you have seen progress. And that's why I always say I got to preface it by saying we have to do more, because these changes aren't going to happen overnight. Now, so we got to keep rolling up our sleeves. We got to keep addressing these issues. We got to talk about implicit bias. We have to talk about privilege. We have to talk about all these things that are, again, like Amy said, driving down voter turnout, driving down confidence in law enforcement. But you got to keep moving forward.
You know, you bring to mind something that I want to take an audio clip now from Larry Miller, who is an activist who has been involved in what's been going on in Ferguson. And he, too, points out to what you have. These conditions are not new. They caught a lot of people by surprise, white people primarily. But it was not news to what was going on in the Black community. Here is Larry Miller.
Just the things that was happening before Mike Brown, it was like business as usual. You know, it never came up. It's like it was all of the straws that was piled up. It wasn't just that one Mike Brown straw that broke the camel's back. It was all of them. Because when the Department of Justice came and started rounding us up and asking us questions about, the injustices of this area. That's how they found out how to put the decree down, because I was in one of those meetings with the Department of Justice. And it was because of all of the things that had happened here in Ferguson and St. Louis County and in the city that was enough. We just couldn't take it no more.
That's Larry Miller, an activist who was certainly active during demonstrations following the shooting death of Michael Brown. Rick Rosenfeld, I want to come back to you because I know you have to leave momentarily, but just want to get your reaction to what's been said so far and also point out that the Justice Department report, 7 or 8 months following the Michael Brown shooting, clearly indicted the Ferguson Police Department. Do you have any sense that the department has made any significant improvement since then?
Well, I don't know that I would call it all that significant. There are improvements underway, and actually others of your guests could actually speak more directly to that, Don. Let me push back, though, respectfully on this notion that African-American communities are over-policed. I don't think they are, or I don't think the problem is over-policing. I think the problem is the wrong kind of policing. Nationwide, African-Americans are twice as likely as are whites to want more police officers in their communities. They obviously don't want police officers who behave in an unfair, biased, or excessively forceful way. But they do want protection from crime. So I don't think the issue is over-policing per se. I think the question we all have to confront is how to change policing so that it genuinely serves our communities.
Community policing is what you're talking about, I assume.
Correct.
Yeah, all right. And Amy Hunter, you had an expression on your face like you weren't quite buying. Rick, before we continue, Rick, I know you have to go because it's just about 12:30.
Okay.
Thank you for your input. I appreciate your time. We'll talk more down the road.
Thank you, Don. Thank you, everyone. Bye-bye.
Back to
Amy.
Yeah,
I'm going to offer like the magic of words, right? So I think it's hard for white people to imagine this policing like broadly used. So policing happens not just by police, but by white people generally speaking. We go to the mall and we are watched and followed, not just by store people, but regular everyday people. And so policing broadly I would offer, if you haven't lived in a black community, you may not understand what over-policing looks like. It's not just the presence of police, which often makes white people feel incredibly comfortable. They feel safe and secure. Seeing a presence of a lot of police in black neighborhoods often does not emote that same kind of security, right? Something has happened. And all the fear that goes into that. So again, the over-policing of kind of more to Wesley's point of we have to worry about if something is happening, will they come? Will they come in a timely manner? Will they come before everything pops off? And then will I be safe when they come? That's a lot of over-policing. And so I think using that term and terminology is much broader than just the presence of police, but actually what happens when they show up, if they show up, and how that relates to our entire lives. So children are over-policed in schools by teachers, for example. People are over-policed in malls. So I think it's much broader than, again, the police department.
You know, I've been around for a while, and Amy, I have to say that I heard people like yourself saying the same thing for 40 years.
Yep.
It hasn't really changed very much in 40 years.
No, except I think people are now saying enough. Like, I think that's what's changing. I think that was the beauty in Ferguson. And I know that this gets articulated in some, you know, rioting, but I hope people can see the beauty of people saying enough. We can actually imagine a world where people are not afraid of the police, where we look forward to seeing police, where we look at least feel safe and secure when police are showing up someplace. Like, I think that is the beauty of what happened in Ferguson, Missouri, that the world is responding in a way to say we've not only had enough, but we can actually imagine a world where we can live freely.
I have to take a break. But Wesley Bell, I want to come to you because would it be fair to say, do you think, that one bright spot out of this whole mess with Michael Brown and what followed is the fact that it is getting people to talk about these inequities, a lot more people than has been the case in the past, much beyond just a regional discussion?
Yeah, unfortunately, out of tragedy oftentimes comes opportunity. You hate to see a young man lose his life, same age as my son. So what we do is what matters, what we do from this point. What do we try to do to correct some of these systemic issues that we see that have been present throughout the history of this country?
Well, I take that break, and I want to come back with Bill Frivel when we do take this pause to talk about that, what might be done legislatively. I mean, that's got to start someplace. That's a good place to start. We'll do that. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We are talking about change or the lack of it following the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson 3 years ago, almost to the moment. And with me in studio are Amy Hunter, the manager of diversity and inclusion for St. Louis Children's Hospital. Bill Freivogel is an attorney and a journalist, and he is joining us by phone. And in studio is Wesley Bell, also an attorney, a member of the Ferguson City Council. I want to turn to Bill Freivogel now. Bill, you heard Wesley Bell talk about the need for change and how to affect it. It would seem to me that the state legislature is a pretty good place to start, but kind of review for us what I might call a lack of effort or a lack of initiative on the part of the legislature in dealing with these issues during the last session or last couple of sessions. What do you think?
Well, I agree with you, Don. I mean, the only Ferguson piece of legislation that was passed the year after Brown's killing was Senate Bill 5, and that's the one that tried to put a 12.5% lid on how much municipalities could collect from traffic violations to run their cities. The Supreme Court threw that lid out, although they did impose a tougher lid of 20%, tougher than it had been in the past. It in the past has been 30%. So that big effort by the legislature, which really only had touched on part of the problem, was not as effective as it might have been. I mean, I think one of the really big contributions of Ferguson to our perception of how the justice system works is the realization that there were all sorts of people who have not committed any crimes who were in municipal holdovers just because they didn't have a license or they couldn't pay their fines or they hadn't appeared in court. But all of these are non-criminal acts, and it really took, Thomas Harvey and Art City Defenders, lawyers at St. Louis University Law School, to bring this to light. There have been some advances, but so much more could be done. I mean, for example, there are a lot fewer people in municipal holdovers. Fines collected in municipal courts are down from $53 million in 2015 to $29 million this past year, but still they're still very high. Something the state legislature could do to really make a difference would be for them to say you have to have at least a population of 5,000 people to run a municipal court. That would eliminate 40 of the tiny little courts in St. Louis County that have caused so much of the problem. So there are fixes that the legislature, if it really took this seriously, could take. The Congress could take steps too. I mean, they could say, any jurisdiction that is receiving federal funds has to have certain standards of training or certain procedures for disciplining officers who do wrong, or has to report the names of officers involved in misconduct to a national database. I mean, these are things that that we all agree that officers who are involved in misconduct shouldn't be able to go from police department to police department and get new jobs and act badly again. So why don't we pass laws that actually can have the effect of have an effect on that?
And Don, if I could jump in,
of course.
While I agree with a lot of what he said, there's some things that I'm going to push back on, and I think that singling out St. Louis County is passing the buck. These issues have been going on statewide, nationwide. When you look at the legislation that was passed, which was Senate Bill 5, which stated that in St. Louis County, cities could get 12.5%, which was thrown out, and the rest of the state was 20%. Mm-hmm. That's actually ignoring the fact that these issues have predated St. Louis County. And also, the original law, which was the Max Creek Bill, named after an area called Max Creek, was not in St. Louis County.
Let me just interrupt to say that what we're talking about is the cap that would be put on the amount of revenue raised by fines in municipal courts.
Exactly. And so the original bill that capped the revenues from fines, thanks for clarifying that for our listeners, was called a Max Creek Bill. Max Creek is no longer in existence, but that area is in outstate Missouri, not in St. Louis County. Now, having said that, St. Louis County should also be held accountable, but not any different from the rest of the state, where when the analysis is done, we're seeing just as much of these types of practices across the state as in St. Louis County. But it's easier for the state legislator to pass a bill against the St. Louis region than it is the outstate areas.
I have to raise this issue. Bill alluded to it and thought that Congress might be able to do some things that would be helpful in this whole dialogue and discussion. But I have to ask about the national mood, the national administration. Bill alluded earlier to the fact that Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, is taking a look at the consent decrees, including Ferguson's, and might decide to tear that up or alter it in some way. We've got the President of the United States saying he wants and thinks that cops should be rougher when they're making arrests, which is, when you stop to think about that in the context of what we're talking about, you have to wonder. We've got the NAACP, which is telling people, don't come to Missouri. It's too darn dangerous to come here. Amy, let me get your take on that. I mean, we know what people want to do, what you want to do, and what a lot of people want to do. But they've got this staring them in the face.
Yeah, I mean, 45 has definitely made conversations about race and racism sexier.
45 being Trump.
Absolutely. And so we've seen that in every institution that and people's lives. Right. So when the head of our country is saying be rougher on police, I can assure you on citizens. I can assure you that it doesn't make me sleep at night any easier as a mother of three sons. And I think that is the crux of it. Like here in St. Louis, we have an opportunity to prove to the world that we could be better, because I actually believe that we are better. I've stayed after Ferguson happened. I've had offers to leave this town, and I've stayed because I am committed to the region that I live in. And I know really good people. We have witnessing whiteness groups with white people who are trying to figure out how to eliminate racism in their lives and in the institutions that they belong to. I think that we're going to need to see more of that, really to resist the sexiness of 45 and what he's presenting. I don't think Sessions going to help Black or brown people. We can see of the walls and the border conversations, it's not helping any of our Latino brothers and sisters either. And so I think we as a community are going to have to come together. And I mean that all of us, not just the Black people here, not just the brown people here, but the white people too, and say enough. We want our city to be better. We want to be proud of our city. We do not want travel bans here. We're going to prove to the world that we can actually do some reform, change who we were before, and make ourselves a place where people actually want to live.
Bill, is Bill Freivogel, is there any real hope that our legislature is going to deal with this? And I say that because we've talked many times about the rural-urban divide. Is that what gets in the way of progress in the troubled urban systems?
Yeah, I think it does get in the way. I don't really have hopes very high of the Missouri legislature or this Congress taking the actions I said they could take. The legislature did take that action in Senate Bill 5 of putting that really tight lid of 12.5% on St. Louis County municipalities because the rural legislators could agree on beating up on St. Louis County municipalities, many of which were actually centers of African American political power in North St. Louis County. So that one was sort of an easy one for them, and it was unfair for them to set a different lid on St. Louis County from the rest of the state. I'm glad the state Supreme Court took care of that. But yeah, you're right, Don. This Missouri legislature is not really one that I think we can look at to bring about the reforms, and I'm afraid the same applies to the U.S. Congress.
The in many ways, this all may hinge on something called leadership and having people in the position where they do take a leadership position and, in fact, get things to change. I want to play another clip now from one of our listeners who called in at our request to offer some ideas as to how change has been made and how their life has been affected by change. This is Nick Kassoff, and he called in. Let's hear what he had to say.
The events of Michael Brown Jr.'s death and following have changed my life by making me more aware of the prejudice and injustice that is so prevalent throughout the St. Louis area. I've made a commitment in my life to work hard to change things, and that's taken up a lot of my time over the last few years. As far as how it's changed the region, I see a lot of committees and a lot of people collecting paychecks and leading conversations, but when you look at it, things really haven't changed. The same people are in charge, most of the same policies are here, and I think that blacks are just as poor, disenfranchised, and discriminated against as they were 3 years ago. So we still have a lot of work to do, both in Ferguson and the St. Louis region.
Amy Hunter, you have another interesting expression on your face.
I disagree. I think the power of Ferguson is that people had an opportunity to band together and to protest and to ask for what they wanted in the kind of St. Louis that they wanted. And I don't think that that's forgotten. And, you know, with all respect to Mike Brown's family, you know, what a huge sacrifice for the possibility of everyone else's liberation. And I don't mean that just for black or brown people. I mean that for white people, too. I don't think it's the same. I think people have experienced something that they will never forget. And hopefully they will hold on to those experiences to know that real change can happen. But it's not going to happen overnight, and we have to be consistent.
I have to take another break. I want to come back and talk a little bit more about this issue of leadership when we do come back. And I also want to talk about the media's role in all of this. I think it's an important one. We'll do that in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back as we continue our conversation on the situation in our community and our nation 3 years after Michael Brown's death in Ferguson. It was 3 years ago today that he was shot and killed by Officer Darren Wilson. We're talking about that with Amy Hunter, Manager of Diversity and Inclusion for St. Louis Children's Hospital. Wesley Bell is an alderman in the city of Ferguson. He wears many other hats as well. We'll stick with that one for just a moment. And Bill Freivogel is a journalist and an attorney. He's joining us by phone. The other two are with me in studio. Bill, I'll come back to you because I want to just address momentarily this issue of leadership. It occurs to me that what this area lacks, this region lacks, is a leader. We've got lots of leaders. We've got lots of mayors. And we have others who are in positions of power. But there's not one person who can get on the white horse and hold the banner and speak for a lot of us. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I agree with you, Don. I mean, I don't think any. I think most people looking back at the events of 3 years ago and then the months that followed would say that former Governor Nixon did not do an effective job of leading St. Louis County Supervisor Dooley did not do any. Was sort of almost a lame duck at that point, and
yeah,
and didn't really wasn't able to be very effective. Lacey Clay was around, but I can't say as though he exerted a huge amount of leadership. So if you look at the elected leadership, I'm not sure that they did a very good. As a matter of fact, I feel certain they didn't do a very good job. Now, on the flip side, though, I would say that an interesting thing is that there has been a new generation of young leaders in St. Louis and St. Louis County who have emerged from the events of the Ferguson protests. And their manifestation was really clear in the election of a new St. Louis circuit attorney last year, and a very strong showing in the St. Louis mayor's race during this past spring. So I think we can be encouraged that there is a young emerging leadership that, you know, maybe even is getting close to taking positions of elected leadership where they can be stronger than some of our past elected leaders.
Well, Wesley Bell, he might just have identified you. I mean, because you fall into that category.
I think long gone are the days of the, at least in our area, our region, long gone are the days of the politician who gets involved just for a paycheck. I think even when I ran, I knew that it was going to require a lot of work, rolling up your sleeves and getting involved, because you can't hide, particularly as a Ferguson on the Ferguson board or St. Louis City and several cities around the area. You can't hide. And so if you're in it for a paycheck, which many of these positions don't pay anything or much of anything, but that's beside the point. I think you have to be willing to get involved. You have to be able to do, you have to get out and do things. You have to build. You have to, you know, we get out and we find what our residents need, be it through donation drives, be it backpack giveaways. It takes time, but I think that is what you're seeing with a lot of the leadership, a lot of these newer generation leaders, if you will.
Yeah, Amy, it seems more organic to me that the leadership is coming actually from the street, if you will, particularly if you look back over the last couple of years.
Absolutely. I think the conversation that we're having really is that it's not white male leadership. I think there are plenty of leaders. At St. Louis Children's Hospital, Joan Magruder is our president. She is leading. She's leading these conversations around diversity and racial equity within the healthcare system. There are Tashara Jones is leading in St. Louis City conversations around what education could look like for St. Louis City children. Mike McMillan is leading the Urban League. And so I think, you know, I think this conversation of like, where are our leaders? You know, we don't have any leaders. I think, you know, kind of that's code for we don't have any white male leaders that are leading this. We don't have our old boys club called Civic Progress anymore leading the way, the entire way in running our school systems and our political structures. I think we would be remiss if we were waiting on all politicians to lead the way. I certainly saw leadership in Ferguson, leadership activists from 20-year-olds. And so I think, again, we are having this conversation like, where are the leaders? The leaders are everywhere. If we would just open our eyes, this isn't like Ferguson has made. These people existed before and we ignored them in our region. So if we have an opportunity to do anything, we have an opportunity to embrace the brilliance that is here, hire, retain, and change our system so that they want to stay here in the region. But leadership is everywhere.
You know, we have an email here from, I think it's from Nicole, I'm not quite sure, but she points to Mayor Crewson and Mayor Crewson's action on the Confederate Monument in Forest Park, at least as being a start, and some of the people that she has hired. And she writes, let's see if she keeps it up. Let's see if she speaks as someone who at least has a glimmer of understanding of Black Lives Matter, as all lives do, of course, she writes, but are all too often not treated as if they mattered equally. Is that a leadership a leader for us?
Well, I wanted to first address the comment with the Black Lives Matter, because I think a lot of people still today confuse this. Black Lives Matter is not meant to say only Black Lives Matter. It's not to say that Black lives only matter. It means that Black lives matter also. We know the importance of as Amy has discussed, that when we see other communities, particularly our white brothers and sisters, when we see something happen with them, how it runs the news, it runs the news cycles. What we're talking about is a lot of our disconnected, disenfranchised, poor communities, which happen to overwhelmingly be African American, we don't see the same sense of urgency to correct a lot of these problems. So I just want to push back on that. We don't have to qualify it by saying all lives matter. We know that. But what we're talking about is we don't want to co-opt a message that is important, that people need to understand that Black lives also matter as well.
Yeah. We have an email here from Madonna, who writes, according to the most recent census report, 65% of the white registered voters voted the most recent presidential election, compared to 52% black. This predates the most recent voting law changes in Missouri. How is the low black voter turnout contributing to the lack of real change for black residents?
If every black person had voted, Donald Trump still would have won. So, I mean, we're going to have this conversation in reverse often, right? So, like, at some point, we're going to have to ask white people to vote in a way that benefits the lives of all people, including black and brown people. And so thank you for holding the shoulders of our voting and political structure on the arms and the shoulders of 13% of the population. But I think we keep missing this conversation about, you know, most white women voted for Trump. And he has nothing good to say about white women. And so at some point, we're going to have a conversation about, hey, maybe white people could vote in a different way instead of always putting the onus on the 12 or 13% of black people who did or didn't vote during this election. I mean, I think, again, we in St. Louis, we are going to have to embrace a hopeful spirit, which means that we are going to hope for a better future together and collectively. And that better future means that black mothers are not and black fathers are not worried about their kids driving a car down the street, right? That we are not praying that a police officer doesn't kill them. Until that changes, we're not moving in the right direction. And so I think we keep saying, well, what about the black people? The black people could solve all the problems. The black people did not create this problem. I'm not saying that we have no power or no structure or that there aren't things that we can do collectively as a community. What I will say is that white people are going to have to change too. And I actually believe in the power of white people to change. Like, I'm not giving up on white people. I don't think that they're all in rural America like we like to typecast them. The white people in Chesterfield also voted for Trump. And so at some point, we're going to have conversations with people who live a little closer to us about why they did such a thing and the impact it's having on our lives. Because I'm terrified for my children with 45 in office.
Bill, do you want to add anything to that? I want to move on to media and you in a moment, but anything to add to what's just been said?
Well, I mean, I agree. We can't blame African-Americans for Donald Trump's election. And it's really unfortunate. I mean, it's really unfortunate that all around the country, Republican legislatures are involved in passing voter rules to, you know, limit early voting, to require more identification of voters, all things that are voter suppression acts that are just more sophisticated than what used to be done in the South with trying to keep African Americans from voting in the numbers they might.
I'm going to take a very quick call here because it's to the point. It's Myrna calling from St. Louis. Myrna, make your point, but do it quickly, please. We're running out of time.
Okay. I just heard the previous caller touch on this, but the whole issue with racism in the United States was created by white people, and it's white people that are going to have to fix it, correct it, and make changes.
Thank you, Myrna. I think she just confirmed what you've been saying, Amy Hunter. No question about that. Let me get to the media in the couple of minutes that remains, because the media obviously plays an important role in all of this. Bill, I'll start with you. Are you satisfied with the performance of media in general during the Michael Brown incident, the immediate aftermath, and since?
Well, I thought the most important media trend that occurred after the shooting was the demonstration of the incredible power of social media, especially Twitter, to take the story of what happened in Ferguson out to the world. They were able, the people who were tweeting were able to get their story out way faster than the traditional media. I mean, the first photo of Michael Brown lying in the street was tweeted out just a few minutes after the event occurred. I hasten to point out that not all of those tweets turned out to be accurate about what happened, but they did get across the story of white officers too often shooting African American suspects in situations that could have been de-escalated, as the Michael Brown case could have been de-escalated. I thought the St. Louis Post took it closer to home. I thought St. Louis Public Radio and St. Louis Post-Dispatch both did quite good jobs of covering the story. I would say particularly the St. Louis Post-Dispatch's editorial page was very strong on reforming the municipal courts and investigating what had happened. St. Louis Public Radio was involved in all sorts of efforts to try to explain what happened. You know, that we live here, podcast being an outgrowth of that. You know, nationally, I guess I would, the organization I would most compliment would be the Washington Post. They've been doing a continuing effort to try to point out how many African Americans are shot and other suspects are shot by police, and have drawn a lot of attention recently to the fact that a lot of officers who have been involved in misconduct are able to go to other departments and re-engage in misconduct.
Let me interrupt you here because time's just about up, and I want to get a very quick response to the media point from Amy Hunter and from Wesley Bell, but it has to be very quick.
I think the media is really important. I think we were looking for reliable news sources. I also think that the media got schooled really quickly during Ferguson as people were taking on their own stories, telling their own narratives, and really not trusting the system of media. So I think this has been a wake-up call for the media to say, hey, people don't really trust you, and they don't trust that you're going to report it well.
10 seconds or so.
You know, I say it's a mixed bag. I agree with some of Bill's points. There was some media that did outstanding jobs, but then there are some that did not do their homework. And I'm going to use an example. Donald Trump was an example of not doing their homework and legitimizing him by giving him so much credit. Now, I will say this. For those who supported him, I'm willing to forgive you if you never do anything like that again.
Yeah.
But I think the media does have to make sure. And I think, to Amy's point, they're finding their running legs.
We've got to end it right there. Wesley Bell, thank you for being with us. Amy Hunter, thank you.
My pleasure.
And Bill Freivogel, thank you so much for being with us. I'll point out that tomorrow, former police chief Tom Jackson, he's written a book about all this. He'll be on the program. That's tomorrow. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/STL on air. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.